Okay, well, you probably know that Israel divided after Rehoboam became the king. But did you know that that wasn't the first time the nation divided? Have you ever thought about that? No, it wasn't. Before the complete division, there were many other cracks and at least one major division that took place before it. When we study about how Israel divided, it is easy to overlook the root causes for the division, which existed long before the complete division took place. Just as the Civil War in our country had root causes that occurred over 100 years prior to the actual division, likewise, Israel's division did as well. Normally, when we talk about how the United Kingdom of Israel became divided, we read about the foolish decision of Solomon's son Rehoboam and how it caused the northern tribes of Israel to rebel against him, but the southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin remain loyal. And that's about as far as we usually go as far as talking about the division of the kingdom. Today, we're going to take a deeper look at this division to see the initial tribal tensions that preceded it, in order that we may have a better, more complete understanding of what was going on when it divided. So please open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 37, verse 2. Genesis 37, verse 2. So our message tonight is titled, Early Cracks That Divided the Kingdom. And you can't get much earlier than the book of Genesis, so that's where we're starting tonight. The first indication of weakness within the family of Israel occurred long before the nation ever lived in the Promised Land. We see that there was disunity. Tension between the sons of Israel, that is, Jacob's sons, existed from the very beginning. Jacob's favoritism toward Joseph in particular fueled the anger of his brothers against him. Genesis 37 says, "This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flock with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him." And of course, we know the rest of the story. They conspired against Joseph, took his special coat from him, threw him in a pit, and sold him to Ishmaelite slave traders, who in turn sold him as a slave in Egypt, and you know the rest of the story. Although these issues weren't the same ones that divided the kingdom, what I want you to see is that this does show that Jacob's family had problems with unity among the brothers from the very beginning. Jacob's polygamous family produced an uneasy tension among his wives and also among his sons, who were brothers and half-brothers with one another. This tension would eventually reveal itself in cracks in their family wall. Now then, to more fully understand how the nation of Israel operated, it helps to learn about the various positions each tribe had within it. There were various privileges and roles that they had. So please open your turn to Genesis 49. Genesis 49. Okay. As we look at Genesis 49, I'm reminded of how in many yearbooks, the seniors get to give their prophecies of what's going to happen in the life of each of their classmates and sometimes fellow students. And supposedly, you know, you look back at those prophecies and laugh years later. But that same idea we see here in Genesis 49, except it's all serious. So when Jacob was nearing death, he was on his deathbed, he pronounces prophecies for each of his sons. And the idea is that each of these prophecies is what will happen in their lives and in their families, the various tribes in the future. So Jacob's prophecies concerning his sons reveals a difference in roles and privileges among them and their tribes. Look at Genesis 49, verse 1. It says, "Then Jacob called for his sons and said, 'Gather around so I can tell you what will happen in days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel.'" So notice he tells them right at the very beginning, "I'm going to tell you what will happen in days to come." These are prophecies about what will happen in the future. "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power." That's all good. But then the prophecy goes, takes a turn for the worse. He says, "Turbulent as waters, as the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it." So Jacob's prophecy concerning his firstborn son, Reuben, is that he, and thus his tribe also, would lose his privileged position over the rest. The firstborn son and his tribe would not enjoy firstborn status. MacArthur has this note on here. He says, "The seriousness of Reuben's sin was not forgotten. Its consequences erased his birthright and whatever dignity and majesty he might have had. His tribe received scant mention in Israelite history and produced not one judge, prophet, military leader, or other important person. Moses prayed that for this tribe not to die out." So you see how that took place over the period of Israel's history, that the tribe of Reuben really fell from prominence and apparently almost died out. Now in Genesis 49 verse 5, Jacob continued his prophecy saying, "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly. For they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce and so their fury so cruel." So here he's showing his disapproval of their anger and the way that they exercise vengeance at Shechem in particular. But notice what the prophecy is here. "I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel." So because of the way that Simeon and Levi had behaved in their lives, they would be scattered throughout Israel. Well, that is Jacob's prophecy. What happened to those tribes? Well, Simeon became the smallest tribe in Moses' second census and later shared territory with Judah. So it also was reduced in importance. And Levi was scattered throughout Israel as the priestly tribe. So although it enjoyed a privileged status, it was scattered throughout the nations. It did not have its own territory that it could claim for itself. Okay, now what does Jacob say will happen to Judah and his tribe? Genesis 49, verse 8. "Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his." So, Jacob here is prophesying that Judah will take a leadership position over Israel. God chose David, as we know, out of Judah's tribe, to be king and established his dynasty, thus solidifying Judah as the kingly tribe in Israel. And so what we need to see here is that the various tribes enjoyed various degrees of privilege and within Israel, and some had special roles that distinguished them from the rest. In 1 Chronicles 5, God also identified Judah as having a leadership role among the tribes. It reads, "The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel. So he could not be listed in the genealogical record in accordance with his birthright. And though Judah was the strongest of his brothers and a ruler came from him, the rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph." During the days of the judges, the uneasy tension that had existed for many years between Israel's tribes began to cause cracks in their relationships. The first major crack was a big one. It was a civil war. Please turn to Judges chapter 20. Judges chapter 20. Here we see that the rest of Israel's tribes fought a war against the tribe of Benjamin when that tribe refused to allow some evildoers from their tribe to be executed for their crime. We're not going to look at Judges 19. It would add a lot of time to this message, and it's already long enough. But the chapter before this, in 19, tells the grisly story of how the men of Gibeah demanded that one of their citizens hand over his guest so that they could sodomize him. But when the citizen refused to do so, the guest gave them his concubine instead, and they raped and abused her so harshly that she died shortly afterward. When the rest of Israel's tribes heard about what had happened in Gibeah of Benjamin, they were rightly outraged, and they came together as an army to demand that the Benjamites hand over these evildoers so that they could execute them. And that's where chapter 20, verse 11 begins. Judges 20, verse 11. Read along with me. It says, "So all the men of Israel got together and united as one man against the city. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, 'What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now surrender those wicked men of Gibeah so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel.' But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites." Imagine what a thing to fight for, huh? Defending people like that. Imagine that. It actually shows you how far gone that area was, that they actually defended these people. After several battles in which large numbers of Israelites died, verses 46 through 48 tell about how the rest of the tribes finally defeated the Benjamites. Look there with me. Verse 46. "On that day, 25,000 Benjamite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant fighters." And then go down to verse 48. "The men of Israel went back to Benjamin, put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across, they set on fire." So, what do we see? First of all, there were a couple battles before this, and a whole bunch of the rest of Israel was killed in those battles. But the last battle, a whole bunch of the Benjamites died. 25,000, it says. And then, after that, they set their towns on fire. So this was a terrible civil war that took place within Israel and was truly a crack in their unity. Well, the next major event, which helps us to understand how Israel divided and the way that it did, took place when Saul became king over a united Israel, a united kingdom. 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1 says, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish." And it goes on to read, "He had a son whose name was Saul." Surprisingly, Israel's first king was not from the tribe of Judah, which we would have expected since that was the prophecy of Jacob. Judah, of course, was to be the kingly tribe. But Israel's first king was from the tribe of Benjamin. This is important to understand because when David eventually became king, the family of Saul, who were Benjamites, sometimes harbored hostility toward David's family, who were of Judah. And so there was a lot of tension between David's family and Saul's family, and there was also some tension between the tribes of the north and the tribe of Judah, which was in the south. All of this contributed to the eventual division of Israel's United Kingdom. But prior to that, we see another crack in its unity as another civil war occurred. And this time that civil war was divided Israel between the tribes of the north and the tribe of Judah, which was in the south. Please turn your Bibles to 2 Samuel 2. 2 Samuel 2, verse 1. Here we see a civil war, the second civil war in Israel, which was a war between the family of Saul and its king Ishbosheth and the family of David, which was in Judah. So here we see David, who is king over Judah, reigning from Hebron, mentioned in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Verse 1 says, "In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?' he asked. The Lord said, 'Go up.' David asked, 'Where shall I go?' 'To Hebron,' the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." Now don't forget that David, his capital was in Hebron, because that's going to make, we're going to bring that in later to show the importance of that city. Israel's king, I'm sorry. Now, skip down to verse 11. Verse 11 says, "The length of time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months." When it sometimes it's rounded off to just say 7 years, but this gives us the complete time. "While David was king over Judah, Saul's son Ishbosheth became king over the rest of Israel in the north." Look at verse 8. It says, "Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, Ashuri, and Jezreel, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel." Ishbosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David, it says. So you have two kings, two kingdoms. You have David in Judah and Ishbosheth over the rest of Israel. So there you see a division that was took place in that time. Now turn to chapter 3, verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. It reads, "The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker." And then we know that after some wicked men murdered Ishbosheth, the war ended and David's family won the war. So then, it's fairly easy to see as you read through these passages that there was plenty of bad blood between Saul's family, with those who loved Ishbosheth in the north, and David's family in Judah in the south. Once Ishbosheth died, David was a strong enough leader that he was able to overcome all of this bad blood and unite the nation. Not surprisingly, the first thing he does after he becomes king over all Israel is to completely unite the nation. Please turn to 2 Samuel chapter 5. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. Here we see a reunited kingdom, more united than ever before under David. The first thing that we see is tribal unity. Look at verse 1. "All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, "You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler." When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron," notice the king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, "and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. Now, here's something that we can easily miss from these verses. Verse 3 says that David made a compact or covenant with the tribes of Israel before they made him their king. Now, we don't know what was detailed in that agreement, but there must have been some things that both David and Israel's leaders had to agree upon before Israel's leaders would allow David to reign over them. So they didn't just go and say, David, we want you to reign over us. We want to make you our king. No, that's not what they did. They came to David and they said, okay, let's have an agreement here. Let's make a contract. These are your responsibilities. These are our responsibilities. And after once those responsibilities became clear and it was all legal, then they said, okay, now we'll make you our king. Something important to remember. So when is a contract necessary? When reassurance is needed for parties to trust one another to uphold their responsibilities. So you see that when the leaders of Israel came to make David their king, there was a little bit of uneasiness there. It wasn't just automatic. They had to have an agreement. They had to have a compact before they did it. Well, after David became king over all of Israel's tribes, thus establishing tribal unity, the next thing he did was to establish geographical unity, which had never occurred in the past. Look at verse 6. Verse 6 says, "The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there." Now skip to verse 7. It says, "David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David." Skip to verse 9. "David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the City of David. He built up the area around it from the supporting terraces inward, and he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him." John MacArthur says this about David taking over Jerusalem. He said, "Jerusalem was located in the territory of Benjamin near the northern border of Judah, and was excellently fortified because of its elevation in the surrounding deep valleys, which made it naturally defensible on three sides." He goes on to say, "The city had earlier been conquered by Judah, but neither Judah nor Benjamin had been successful in permanently dislodging the Jebusite inhabitants. By taking Jerusalem, David was able to eliminate the foreign wedge between the northern and southern tribes and to establish his capital." So it's really important to notice that David knew that as he became the king over all Israel, that he had this group that was in between the two sides, Judah and Israel, and this group was called the Jebusites. And they were very well fortified in Jerusalem. And the only way that he could geographically unite the whole nation so that it was one nation would be to remove those people and to take over Jerusalem. And, of course, he decided to make it his capital, and that's exactly what he did. This would be very similar to if we were here we are, the United States, and then let's say that right in the state of Missouri, we'll just pick Missouri just randomly here, there's this foreign group that's not part of the United States, and they're not doing what everyone else does. It'd be very similar to that. We would never be able to have complete unity as a nation if that were to happen. Well, so we see that David effectively established greater unity than Israel had ever enjoyed previously. Israel as a nation enjoyed a united kingdom throughout the rest of David and Solomon's reigns. But as it had before, cracks in that wall of unity began to show later in David's reign. One major crack occurred when David's son Absalom usurped his throne. Chapter 15 tells us two things that damaged David's reign over a united Israel. Verse 10, this is chapter 15, verse 10. It says that Absalom set up his throne in Hebron, where David previously had his capital. Remember that? Very important to remember that. It was strategic. So Absalom knew that if he could go right to the heart of where David previously had his support, that it would greatly diminish David's ability to lead that nation. And so David's leadership was seriously weakened where he had previously enjoyed great strength. Verse 13 tells that the hearts of many Israelites turned to Absalom and thus again against David, again weakening greatly David's leadership even more. Now please turn to chapter 16 where we see David at his lowest point as a leader. chapter 16. David's lowest point took place when a Benjamite named Shimei curses David. One of the things that you'll see repeated oftentimes is this hostility between the Benjamites and David's family. Verse 5 says, as King David approached Bahurim, this is when David's on the run from Absalom. He is getting out of the city of Jerusalem. He's leaving. And it's a very sad time for David. He's already been humiliated in this way. And along comes this man named Shimei, who is more than happy to humiliate him some more. It says, as King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family, and of course that's the tribe of Benjamin, he came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. Now he's not using curse words. What he's saying is condemnations and cursings against David, that bad things will happen to David. His name, he pelted David and all the king's officials with stones. Okay, now, what is going on when someone in the Middle East is throwing stones at somebody? They're trying to kill him. They are, in a way, they're symbolically trying to say, you should be executed. You should be put to death. Okay, well, how did they execute people over there? They stoned people, right? So in the Middle East, when they throw stones at people, what they're saying, they know they're not going to kill you. But they know, they're trying to communicate, this is what you deserve. You deserve to be executed. That's what Shimei is doing here. All right, and then it says, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. And of course, we know that David's troops wanted to kill Shimei for this, but David kept them from doing it. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed where in the household of Saul. Okay, he was a man from the household of Saul, and he's getting after David because of what he did to the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. So there's this idea that David's not legitimate as well. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood. Verse 13 says, so David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went and throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. So this happened throughout the whole trip. Shimei's passing along, he continues to throw rocks and stones and dirt at him. It wasn't just a little bit, it was all the whole time. He continued on and went on and on and on. Well, after this humiliation, another crack in Israel's unity became apparent. One result of David's weakened leadership became noticeable when it was time for David to return to the throne. At that time, division among the tribes became evident once again. Turn to chapter 19. According to this chapter, David's leadership ability had been weakened to the point that Israel's tribes actually were arguing over whether or not he should be restored to the throne. Think about that. Think of all the ways that God had powerfully used David before and after he became the king. It's really mind-boggling when you think of all the things that David had done for Israel. Definitely Israel's greatest king ever. And they were actually arguing over whether he should be restored to be the king. That's how weak his leadership was at that point. Let's read verse 9. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled the country because of Absalom, and Absalom, whom we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? So this is the arguments that were going on. Some were saying, no, don't bring the king back. And others are saying, well, why don't you want us to bring the king back? Let's bring him back. And then it says, King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, ask the elders of Judah. So David knows where where his most loyal supporters should be. He says, ask the elders of Israel, saying, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood. Why should you be the last to bring back the king? Now, the next thing you see, David wasn't just a guy who went out and killed people. David had some political savvy in him as well, as you read about David and learn about him. Notice what he says next. And say to Amasa, who was Absalom's general, okay, this is a political mover, say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab. Well, guess what? Amasa, help me out here and you get to be my new general and goodbye to Joab, because quite frankly, David didn't care for Joab too much at that point in time anyway. He was pretty mad at Joab. And then, of course, it says here that referring to Amasa, it says he won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, return, you and all your men. So Amasa was favorably impressed with the prospect of becoming David's general, and he used that political advantage to be able to restore David to the throne. Then it says, then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan. Now notice what it says next. Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. What's significant about that? You don't see the men of Israel there. That's what's significant. It only says the men of Judah. So that creates a problem. The men of Israel weren't with them, and thus they became angry and offended that they were not included in restoring David to the throne. So once again, we see this division between Israel and Judah. Well, apparently some men from Israel after this did eventually join in the restoration, but not all of them. Look at verse 40. When the king crossed over to Gilgal, Kimham crossed with him. All the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Soon, all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, look at what they're saying, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men? Okay, what are they saying? They're saying, look, you guys did this unilaterally, and you're trying to cut us out of the future of the nation. Why weren't we there to be a part of restoring David? They're not happy. They're very angry about this. Well, the men of Judah weren't too happy either. It says here, all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel. We did this because the king is closely related to us. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves? So they're trying to say that they didn't take unfair advantage of their status as David's brothers. Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king. And besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have. So why do you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? But the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel. So who can tell me how many tribes were in the north? 10. So that's what they're talking about. We have 10 shares in the king. And you just have one. So they're trying to say, if anybody should be restoring David to the throne, it's us. And thus receiving the political benefit that would accompany afterwards once David was on the throne. But what I want to point out to you here, once we see once again the hostility between the tribes of the north and the tribe of Judah. And only this time the hostility erupted into rebellion against David. Turn to chapter 20, verse 1. Chapter 20, verse 1. Here we see that there was a temporary division once again where Sheba and Israel revolted against David. It says, now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, oh, guess what? A Benjamite. You didn't see that coming, did you? He happened to be there. He sounded the trumpet and shouted, look at what he says. We have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So all the men of Israel deserted David to follow Sheba, son of Bichri, but the men of Judah stayed by their king all the way from the Jordan to Jerusalem. Did you notice the contrast between chapter 19, verse 43, and the beginning of chapter 20? In 1943, all the men of Israel saying, "We have 10 shares in the king." Now, just a few verses later, they're saying, "We have no share in the king." So this one man, Sheba, son of Bichri, was able to sway the nation, the tribes of Israel against David fairly quickly. Now, verse 2 says, "All the men of Israel followed Sheba while those of Judah stayed with David." So then, what have we seen so far? We're starting to get close to the division of the kingdom. What have we seen? Well, we've seen disunity among Jacob's sons. We've seen variation in privileges and roles among the tribes. We've seen a civil war between the tribe of Benjamin and the rest of Israel, ending in Israel's victory over Benjamin and the near extinction of that tribe, as if you know the story. We know that there was a political unity that was achieved by Saul over all the tribes. And then after Saul's death, there was a civil war between Saul's family and David's. David's family became victorious after Saul's son Ishbosheth is murdered by wicked men. Then David reunites Israel and Judah, this time achieving an even greater unity than ever before, because the nation was united geographically, completely united for the first time. Before the northern tribes of Israel agreed to make David their king, he entered into a contractual agreement with them. And we see that David's son Absalom dramatically weakened his authority over the tribes with his failed attempt to usurp the throne. Then a man named Shimei from Saul's clan, and thus a Benjamite, curses David as he's on the run from Absalom, which was a very serious offense. It was worthy of capital punishment. The tribes of Israel argue over whether or not to even restore David to the throne. The men of Israel complain that they've been shortchanged in David's restoration. And just a little later, a man named Sheba, once again from the tribe of Benjamin, leads a revolt against David, with the men of Israel following Sheba and the men of Judah staying with David. So what have we seen? All kinds of disunity, cracks, and division throughout. When there was unity during Saul and David's reigns, it didn't take long to break it up. And then Solomon becomes king. Well, Solomon literally had a united kingdom handed to him on a silver platter. His father, David, had paid the price for it, but Solomon got to enjoy it. No king in Israel ever enjoyed the kind of unity which Solomon enjoyed while he was the king. All 12 tribes united, a time of peace and prosperity that was unparalleled for Israel. And what did Solomon do with this expensive unity? He frittered it away. He squandered it all. As he had amassed his 700 wives and 300 concubines, he allowed them to take his heart away from the Lord, and he began to worship their gods. And that brought God's judgment upon him. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 9. 1 Kings 11, verse 9. It reads, "The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, 'Since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen.'" You notice the natural division that God chooses? What have we seen? This is the same division that we have seen for much of the history of Israel. that was between the northern tribes and the tribe of Judah. And God's saying, okay, this time there's going to be a break and it's going to be for good. By God's grace towards Solomon, the United Kingdom he had inherited would not be divided while he was king, but instead would be divided when his son is king, leaving his son with a much smaller kingdom and just one tribe with its capital city of Jerusalem. And we know God did this not for Solomon's sake, but for David's sake. From this point on, we read about how God tears the kingdom away from Solomon, Solomon's son Rehoboam. Look at verse 26. It begins with a man named Jeroboam. Verse 26, it says, "Also Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zerida." He's rebelling against Solomon here. "And his mother was a widow named Zeruah." Here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this, notice, not just because of Solomon here." He says, "Because they have forsaken me and worshiped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose, and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If," now this is fascinating, he says this to Jeroboam, "if you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever." So just think of that. If Jeroboam had followed God's ways, then he would have had his own dynasty in the northern kingdom and God would have blessed him. Isn't that remarkable? Just think of what could have been in the northern kingdom Israel. As we know, that's not what happened. As we know, Jeroboam immediately took Israel into idolatry, and so that never took place. But that was the promise God had made to him if he had followed his commands. Now then, after this, it looks like King Solomon must have heard about this, because the next verse, verse 40, says this: "Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak the king and stayed there until Solomon's death." God's plan to tear the kingdom away from Rehoboam begins by raising up Jeroboam as a rival, promising to give him the northern 10 tribes of Israel. The second part of God's plan is actually fulfilled by Rehoboam himself, surprisingly. Look at chapter 12, verse 1. And this is where we're coming down the home stretch here tonight. Chapter 12, verse 1 says, "Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king." Why do you think Rehoboam went to Shechem? Why did they want to do it at Shechem? Well, first of all, it was because Shechem was a famous town that was in the tribe of Ephraim in the north, and so it was important to the northern tribes. politically speaking, it was important to them, and it was important for unity within the nation. It was famous because it was a location at which Abraham had built an altar. Jacob had dug a well there, and Israel had performed a famous ceremony recounting the blessings and cursings of the law of Moses. So Shechem was a very strategic site. Then verse 2, when Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, see, we haven't given up on Jeroboam yet. He's still in Egypt, but now he hears about how that Israel has Rehoboam coming up to Shechem to anoint him as king. It says he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon. It says he returned from Egypt. Then, speaking of the tribes of Israel, it says they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days and then come back to me." So the people went away. And you know how this goes. Rehoboam's father's former advisors, the old guard, the old crusty guys, you know, they say, "Rehoboam, you really need to wise up here, okay? You're a young king, and you need to be careful here because you don't have a lot of authority yet. So it would be wise to lighten the load and meet their demands." Basically, cut taxes is what they're saying, because they were being overly taxed to pay for all of Solomon's excesses and had been overly burdened, and they were sick and tired of it. So they gave him wise counsel. But, of course, Rehoboam was too smart for that. He thought, well, you know, I'm the king. I'm going to show them who's king. And so he listened to the young bucks, the guys that were his peers. And they said, you know what? You need to show them who's boss. Tell them, oh, you think Solomon was bad? I'm going to make it even worse on you. I'm going to really put the screws to you. And guess what? That was about the stupidest thing he could have done, of course. Showed total ignorance in the history that we just talked about of Israel and how they just naturally divided upon these lines. And all it took was just a little bit to get the northern tribes to turn against the southern tribes. Now skip down to verse 12. Verse 12 says, 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said, "Come back to me in 3 days." The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." See, Solomon had actually had forced labor to build the temple and to do much of his work. And these people were really sick of that. And so he's saying, guess what? I'm going to be even worse on you. So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah, the prophet, the Shilonite. And that's when we have the complete division that we're going to end with tonight. And guess what? Guess who it's led by? Jeroboam, just as God had promised. Verse 16, when all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel." Anybody ever heard that before? That's the exact same thing that Sheba had said before with David. It's the exact same thing. We're saying, that's it. We're done with this guy. We're out of here. Then they say, "Look after your own house, O David." So the Israelites went home. But for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. King Rehoboam, guess what? He made one stupid decision. Now he goes, guess what? I can make another one. He makes an even more stupid decision. Look at what he does next. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, but all Israel stoned him to death. Isn't that great? It's like, okay, you don't think I'm going to be the king, that I'm going to be the boss? I'll send the IRS after you. And guess what? The IRS guy, he has the compulsorily, supposedly, the ability to make you do it. And that's over really well, isn't it? Everybody wants the IRS guy showing up on their door after they've decided to not pay their taxes, right? Not very smart, not very good. And of course, they stone him to death. And then it says, King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So he barely gets out with his life. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. And as we know, Rehoboam followed all that up by saying, okay, that's it, I'm going to go to war against them. He was all ready to go to war against the northern kingdoms yet again. And God sent a prophet to tell him, no, don't do that. This division is from me. And Rehoboam finally made the first wise decision of his reign, as far as we know, when he said, okay, I won't. And of course, the rest of the story, we have Judah and Israel divided from that point onward. So, next week, we're going to look at Jeroboam and the sin of Jeroboam and how that affected Israel throughout the rest of its history in the northern kingdom, because that was a very serious sin, which we see the refrain continually throughout the rest of the Bible about the sin of Jeroboam. So we're going to look at that next week.